Second Court of Appeals. We have one case on our docket this afternoon, and that is Roger K. Carson versus Robert M. Greenberg et al. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Counsel's ready, Your Honor.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. We will call the first case, and Mr. Nygaard, you may proceed.
May it please the court. As Your Honor mentioned, my name is Chris Nygaard. I represent Roger Parsons. And at the outset of oral argument, I'd like to speak initially to the issue of punitive damages. And you'll see in my first brief, in the appellant's brief, that I actually addressed that issue of punitive damages for 9 pages. And that particular issue doesn't get much time in front of the jury, and I'll get into why that happened in a moment. But the reason that I spent so much time on developing that issue is because this case is not so much about how much money Roger Parsons walked away with in the trial after his wife's death. And it's more about the fact that for 8 years, the appellee lawyers took his money to pursue a claim that really is barred as a matter of law. When the appellee lawyers lost the case against Turley, for which they were hired, pretty soon after that, they filed a motion for summary judgment. And in that motion for summary judgment, they maintained that Parsons could not collect lost punitive damages against them in a malpractice case as a matter of law, because lost punitive damages are intended to punish the defendant, the original defendant, which in this case is DuPont Conoco. Now, they won that summary judgment, and in a serious stroke of irony, because they were hired to pursue the same kind of case against Wendell Turley. That's the damages that they targeted in that case against Wendell Turley. And let me just, in case, just for purposes of review, Wendell Turley was hired by Roger Parsons to prosecute a suit regarding the death of Roger Parsons' wife. Okay, now, and in that suit, Turley's conduct and Turley's decisions, and failure to develop evidence, and a wide variety of decisions led to the judge throwing out the jury's finding that yes, we have gross negligence here, because the judge found that there was insufficient evidence for the jury to find that gross negligence had been committed. And therefore, Parsons was unable to proceed to the damages phase of the punitive damages issue. So all that happened under Greenberg and Motzenbacher's watch, right? Those were the damages for which they took Roger Parsons' money for those 8 years. And then as soon as he turned around and tried to collect those very same damages from them, they came up with the easy argument to make that, well, you can't get lost punitive damages against a lawyer in a malpractice case. Well, that's just wrong. And I've attached the summary judgment motion that the appellee lawyers filed as an appendix in this case. It's a pretty good job, but it probably doesn't go as far as it should, and I wonder if perhaps one reason it might stop short of being as powerful a brief as it could be is that we're trying to avoid pointing to the fact that, hey, if you can't get lost punitives as a matter of law, then what were Greenberg and Motzenbacher thinking going after Wendell Turley in the first place, right? So that's it. That's essentially the core of the case against the appellee lawyers. I mean, it's less a less an issue of how much money was awarded or was not awarded, and more an issue of how can you proceed as an attorney to do that kind of thing as an attorney, given the duties that we owe our clients, our duties to research damages theories, and our duties to our fiduciary duties to the client, and our just how can you proceed that way? That's the inequity in play here. Now, again, I spent 9 pages on that, and that issue didn't exactly make it before the jury. And the reason why it didn't make it before the jury in the way that it should have is due to an August 11th, 2008 sua sponte decision by the first judge in this case, the first trial judge, Judge Davis. Now, I've got copies of that. Mr. New Approach? Okay, by and large, the appellant's and appellee's briefs are in agreement as to the facts in this case. The major point on which they differ has to do with the document you have in your hand right now. Both appellee lawyers' briefs, both Matzenbacher's brief and Greenberg's brief, make the statement that this text that's in the block on the first page here, when we reference it in our brief, that doesn't exist. That this is instead an order that only disallows Parsons from using certain expert witnesses. But so that's why I include this in my reply brief at the end as an appendix. Just really quickly here. In the square here, Judge Davis talks about his June 6, 2008 order, the order removing lost punitive damages from the case. And then in that second sentence, it starts on the fourth line, and this is the key. Based upon that ruling, the court finds that the only alleged damages the plaintiff is entitled to recover in this case are the attorney's fees and expenses that he paid to the defendants and all other expenses plaintiff paid to others, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so this is essentially a sua sponte order, right? I mean, there was no argument whether Parsons' gross negligence or fraud claims that he had that were live claims at the time against Greenberg and Matzenbacher. There was no discussion as to why those should be thrown out along with the lost punitive damages. And the effect of this order, when you say, I mean, this is 2008, August, okay? The effect of this order, when you say that the only thing you're entitled to is the fees paid, that we're not just stripping case within the case malpractice issues. We're stripping malpractice from the case entirely. Negligence is gone from this case. Prior to the Aiken Gump decision that I'll discuss in a moment, you couldn't get attorney fees based on in a malpractice suit. At this juncture, when the judge makes this sua sponte order, really all Roger Parsons has is a case for breach of fiduciary duty. Okay, and the following summer in July, when the next judge, Doug Wilkinson, issues a summary judgment order stripping breach of fiduciary duty as a cause of action from the case, Parsons has nothing. Okay,
and but you tried malpractice.
To answer your question, sir, ma'am, sorry, to answer your question, Your Honor, this case was perilously close to being thrown out before it got to the jury, before the Aiken-Gump decision came down and gave Roger Parsons a basis upon which to move forward, which the Aiken-Gump decision, incidentally, was issued in the middle of my client's jury trial. Okay, way after pretrial, way after exhibits and experts and all that stuff has been decided. And I apologize. I'm not sure whether it's in the record or not, but I was in the room when the judge said, if you will permit me to make this statement, I was in the room when Judge Wilkinson said, had it not been for that Aiken-Gump decision, that Parsons would not admit it to the jury. Okay. So, and that's understandable because he doesn't have a leg to stand on. Negligence is gone. Breach of fiduciary duty is gone, right? And then okay. Let me back up a second to complete my earlier thought, and then I'll address the Aiken-Gump case. All right. What I was talking about was why the punitive damages issue didn't make it before the jury. I mean, why? And the point is that because negligence was stripped from the case, legally, Roger Parsons had no basis upon which to discuss that with the jury. He was relegated to a fee regurgitation argument. And again, before Aiken-Gump came along, he didn't have any legal basis for that as well. Let me get to the Aiken-Gump case. All right, that notation at the top of the page where it says beginning at 121, it's actually beginning at 120. As you'll see, the asterisk, the second to last paragraph on the page is marked asterisk 121, so that's an error. So just that first sentence here in this opinion is quite revealing. The Court of Appeals in this case concluded that attorneys' fees are not recoverable as damages for legal malpractice. Okay, so it's with this case that that my client actually comes into his own and has a working cause of action. Now, normally, when it's interesting that that Judge Davis can make a sua sponte order that finds that fraud and gross negligence and Parsons' other causes of action are gone from the case, but when we're in this area where really there isn't a legally cognizable cause of action to proceed on, that we're still moving forward. I don't pretend to understand that. At any rate, it's understandable that things have developed the way they have. I mean, this is a difficult situation where you've got the Texas Supreme Court releasing an opinion in the middle of a trial of that's being overseen by a first year judge. That must have been pretty touch and go there, trying to get a grasp of this opinion and try to figure out how to apply it to this case. So just to drop back to that sua sponte order again. When you're a pro se plaintiff in a trial and a judge hands down an order like this, I mean, I know Roger Parsons was scratching his head. What's up with this? Why is this happening? And this was the, I believe this is.
It would be helpful if you
Okay. All right. What I see as the fair holding in this case is that the fees that my client paid both on appeal to the Dallas Court of Appeals, to the Texas Supreme Court, and then back down to the Dallas Court of Appeals, and also in the year after the appellee lawyers blew the statute of limitations. All those fees are caused by that initial act of negligence in not in their failure to perfect the lawsuit in time. And so I think the fair holding is that because of that negligence and the proximate cause is clear that that those fees should be refunded. And let me just say that these two incidences of negligence, one in failure to perfect a lawsuit, and two in pursuing that cause of action for lost punitives to begin with, those are inextricably intertwined. And the reason I say that is, normally in the normal course of a trial, your cause of action gets vetted by the other side. They can bring special exceptions. There's all kinds of things leading up to a trial that helps you hone your damages theory. Well, none of that happened in this case because a failure to perfect a lawsuit in time. Okay, so arguably, if counsel for the appellee lawyers can come up with a summary judgment that gets my client's case tossed out regarding lost punitives, probably Wendell Turley's lawyer could have come up with that as well. But she didn't have to, because they perfected the lawsuit late. So, and if an attorney had an opportunity to get something tossed because of a statute of limitations, that's a much easier argument to make. There's no research required for that one. So, given that those two instances of negligence are intertwined like that, the notion that the negligence to fully vet and to research and to properly understand whether a lost punitive damages case could be brought against Wendell Turley, it's very much has a huge presence in this case. And again, were it not for this August 11, 2008 sua sponte order, I think that everything would have turned out very differently. Just one more thing about the conduct of the trial. There's a difference of opinion whether allowing opposing counsel to talk about my client's conspiracy theories in voir dire and then opposing counsel continuing to talk about those elements during the course of the trial is harmful error. And that's another holding I'd like to see come out of this case, because the comments that opposing counsel Lisa Blue made about Googling Roger Parsons with an S, and it's in my brief, the dark conspiracy that he's theorized concerning George H.W. Bush and Secretary Baker and other actors.
Well, let's just assume for a moment that that was clearly erroneous. How does that affect the proof that he's required to put on to prove his causes of action?
It affects him very deeply as the pro se plaintiff, because that strikes at the core of his credibility, And moving forward, it's very difficult for him to...
How is credibility an issue? Either they did or they did not meet the statute. Either they did or did not research an issue that they should have researched. Either they billed a bunch of money or they did not for a cause of action that did or did not exist. I don't see how his credibility is an issue.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Joe Spence. I'm here on behalf of Motzenbacher and Schaefer Davis appellees. Mr. Ross is here on the Motzenbacher appellees. Mr. Sanfilippo is here on the DuPont-Conoco appellees. We've decided to divide our time. I'm going to try and take the first 12 minutes. Mr. Ross will take 8 minutes. Mr. Sanfilippo is not intending to argue at this time, but if the court has any questions about the DuPont-Conoco issues, he's more than happy to answer the court's questions. Let me address Mr. Nygaard's first issue, this punitive damage issue. That issue arises under this umbrella of his complaint that there's factually insufficient evidence, or really that the no answer as to my client, Motzenbacher, on the negligence question is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. And he really says in his brief, there's three instances of negligence where the that shows this no answer as to my client is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. And the first instance that he brings up is this issue that somehow, some way, Motzenbacher and Greenberg were negligent in not researching and determining that loss punitives was not available, and therefore they never should have taken the case to begin with. The first answer to that question of why Mr. Nygaard and Mr. Parsons are wrong.
Wait, they should never have taken the case to begin with, or they should not have been billing fees for something that was a ghost?
Well, it's not entirely clear what the appellant's position is, but I think it's somewhere in the middle of that, because the primary thrust of the original petition was seeking the recovery of lost punitives. So it may very well be that whether they should not have taken the case or proceeded down that road, that was the thrust of the original case against Mr. Turley, that Turley in the original underlying crash case in the Southern District of down in Houston in front of Judge Black messed up and didn't get a gross negligence finding to stick and then get a punitive damages awarded against DuPont Conoco for the crash.
Okay, so your obvious defense of, well, they weren't available, was followed by the question of, then why were you billing me for pursuing?
Absolutely. That's their argument. But okay. The answer to that, the first answer to the question as to this trial and this jury, is that legal theory and no evidence of that legal theory was ever paraded in front of this jury. The jury never heard this theory. And so there is no way for this for the no answer to be against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence when that evidence wasn't even before the jury. They never heard it. And the reason they never heard it is because Mr. Parsons always took the opposite position. No, in fact, lost punitives are covered. His expert Quinn testified, that's volume 23, and Quinn, pages 46 through 179, he talked about due diligence and service of process. He talked about if there had been this lawyer's agreement about Rule 11. But he offered no opinions, never even talked about this idea that Motzenbacher and Greenberg should have researched and found that lost punitives is either unavailable or certainly a weak claim. He never mentioned that before the jury. It's not in their motion for directed verdict. It's not in their motion for new trial. It's not in their JNOV. So simply put, the first and logical answer to their factual sufficiency great weight argument as to the no answer to Motzenbacher is there's no way it can be against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence because the jury never heard it. And there's no evidence in the record of that theory. So that raises the next question. And in our brief, we say the second reason this complaint about the no answer doesn't prevail is because it's been waived. And it's been waived because from the beginning of time up until the appellant's brief in this court, they always took the position that lost punitives were in fact available. It is only until they got to this court and filed their brief that they suddenly reversed field and said, okay, Motzenbacher was right, lost punitives aren't available under the law, they never were, And that's why this no finding is against great weight preponderance of the evidence. And we've cited cases in our brief of how that constitutes a waiver. If you can't take a new position on appeal, you never took below. It's perfectly legitimate to assume that once the lost punitive ruling came down in the summer of 08, that if Parsons really believed that that was the case, he certainly could have zigged or zagged whichever way and suddenly said, okay, in the alternative, if they're not recoverable, then I'm going to add claims to my lawsuit for legal malpractice based on this theory of you should have researched and known. So that's why it's really a waiver in this case. And it was really the horse they chose to ride all the way through. They didn't back off. They could have, but they didn't. And I will say this, the ruling was in June of 08 on the summary judgment of no lost punitives. Trial was not until October of 09. So he certainly had time to amend his pleadings, change his theories, do what he had to do. The next issue is, which I don't think the court reaches, but the substance of this argument about him claiming that, well, lost punitives weren't available in 1998 when Motzenbacher and Greenberg decided to represent Turley, and they should have known that then. I think the issue in the law, I don't think that's a correct argument. And I'm the one that drafted the summary judgment in the court below, and what I argued to the court and what I think is correct, by the time 2008 rolled around, the landscape had drastically changed from 1998 when Motzenbacher and Greenberg were analyzing whether to sue Turley and seek lost punitives. I'll remind the court that in 94, the Moriel decision came out, and Moriel stood for the proposition longstanding in Texas, at least in part, that punitive damages had dual purposes, deterrence, example to others, and then punishment penalty. In 94 and 95, when we had tort reform and they amended Chapter 41, they did take out the deterrence element in the definition of punitive damages and punishment. It was only punishment that was left. In 96, you had BMW versus Gore, and it started that whole series of U.S. Supreme Court cases about these due process concerns of how we apply and allow punitive damages to be assessed procedurally. And then in 2008, the Texas Supreme Court came out with Fairfield, and they finally said, yeah, the legislature meant it. There's only a sole purpose now for punitive damages. It's punishment only. There's no more deterrence. And they said, and this is a key point that we seized on in our motion below, they said, and the legislature has also said that punishment must be directed toward the wrongdoer. And that was the key language in Fairfield in 88 that gave us the position that, okay, now what we know is, in a legal malpractice case, the way the punitive damage landscape has been solidified as of 2008, any recovery of lost punitives by a plaintiff against the malpractice attorney, if you will not be directed as a punishment toward the wrongdoer. And that was essentially the public policy argument we made in 2008. And that's why, even if the court got to this, and again, the jury never heard any of this, there's no way they could have known or not known, but that's why that argument really lacks merit. Next, I would like to briefly discuss the Aiken-Gump issue. I'm not sure that the court gets to it as to my client Motzenbacher if it upholds the no finding on negligence. But I did want to point out a couple of things that I think are important for the court to consider. In this record, the only evidence that Parsons put on, and it wasn't expert testimony, was he put in his checks, his ledger, I think some fee bills, et cetera, and that's what he put in. And he claims from that the jury should have been able to discern his Aiken-Gump attorney's fee recovery. And what Aiken-Gump stands for, the proposition, as best I can tell, it says a plaintiff can recover against the attorney who committed malpractice in a legal malpractice claim against that attorney if you can show that the negligence of the attorney caused the incurrence of these fees. But you have to show which fees those were. And the second thing it says is you can't do this if those fees would have been incurred otherwise. That was kind of the upshot of Aiken-Gump as to the appellate fees that were incurred in that case. The Court of Appeals said, look, those fees would have been incurred anyway, so you can't get those. It's a causation issue.
Is that the erroneous jury instruction?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. But what we know from Agin Gump is they brought in two professors, Professor Dorsanio and Armour, separately paid them $49,500 to Armour, $10,000 to Dorsanio, to look solely at that issue about this jury instruction. And that's all they did. And there was testimony in the record, including from Armour herself, that, yeah, they paid me that. There was no dispute at what they had been paid. And what the court did, and this is interesting, at the very end of the Akin decision, they say, based on the state of the evidence in this case, we would normally render, is what they said, but based on the state of the evidence in this case, we're going to remand to the Court of Appeals to suggest a remittiture, because the evidence was clear from the lawyers themselves of here's what we were paid to do this stuff that was separate and apart from the normal appellate fees. The problem in this case is that Mr. Parsons never segregated or explained to the jury what fees, if any, of all that he paid to Motzenbacher and Greenberg resulted from this allegation of failure to timely serve. In other words, what did he have to pay to fight the summary judgment below on that issue? And he had to show that and segregate it. And it's our position, he not only had to show it and segregate it, but he had to do it with an expert attorney witness. And that's the Alexander case in the Supreme Court. That's, we cite in our brief, it's 146 Southwest 3rd 113. But that case has said, on causation in legal malpractice cases, if the causation element is beyond the lay jury, you got to have an expert. And our position in this case is no jury would just be able to look at all the fee bills and everything and go, okay, this is the fees they paid on this issue that they wouldn't have had to pay otherwise. It was caused by attorney's negligence. Here's fees they would have had to pay otherwise. I believe I've taken up too much time. I apologize. But that's our Akin Gump argument.
May it please the court. My name is Jim Ross, and I believe Mr. Spence accidentally said that I represent Motzenbacher also earlier. And I just want to clarify for the record that I have the privilege to represent Robert M. Greenberg, Legal Services PC, and Robert M. Greenberg, Attorney at Law. I was trial counsel in this case as well, so some of the arguments that have been made about what happened at trial, I was actually present during the entire trial and observed or not, as the case may be, on some of these issues. For simplicity purposes, I want to stick to my argument being primarily at Akin Gump, because Mr. Spence, I think, did a very good job at addressing some of the other negligence issues. And as the court's aware, my client, Robert M. Greenberg, was found negligent on failure to diligently execute the service on in the running of the statute of limitations. However, the jury zeroed out the damages on that. And Akin Gump is a critical part of the court's analysis on why this judgment should be upheld. In Akin Gump, the Akin Gump firm was sued as a result of some issues dealing with what they did or did not do on the jury charge. And when Akin Gump decided to appeal this issue, they retained, as Mr. Spence said, two other law professors who came in specifically for the purpose of looking at these allegedly malpractice issues. This went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and what the Supreme Court said was, yes, indeed, you are entitled to attorney fees on these legal malpractice issues and expenses, but you have to be able to identify and segregate what specific attorney fees went to those issues. And in Akin Gump, what was found was those two law professors were specifically there to address the malpractice issue. It's sort of a but-for analysis, because you can't just say, listen, I paid these lawyers for 8 years, $1 million or whatever the case may be, to prosecute these claims. They were poured out at the very beginning because of the statute of limitations, and because we had to go through the appeals and increase all of these attorneys' fees, when they messed up, we should be entitled to recover those fees. Well, that's not what Akin Gump says. Akin Gump says you have to be able to segregate that you wouldn't have had that appellate process anyway. In other words, there has to have been some type of evidence presented to the jury that would have said, listen, had we have prevailed on the Turley matter, that we never would have had to have expended any fees on appellate issues. And no evidence in any way, shape, or form was ever offered at trial to present that. I agree with Mr. Spence that even had Mr. Parsons tried to testify to that, which he did not, we feel that that would be insufficient, that you would need an expert attorney to testify as to whether or not appeals would have been necessary. So the fact of the matter is, Akin Gump does provide for the recovery of attorney's fees, but you have to present evidence showing specific segregated fees as to why you are entitled to a certain amount. It does not provide a plaintiff in a legal malpractice case a blank check to recover attorney's fees simply because there was an appellate process. The plaintiff in the Akin Gump case did not recover any attorney's fees paid to Akin Gump. They only recovered the attorney's fees for the two professors specifically dealing with the legal malpractice case. The reason is, for the same reason here, they failed to properly segregate and identify what fees went to what matter. And there was no evidence presented in this case as to whether or not the appeals dealing with the statute of limitations wouldn't have been necessary anyway, even had they prevailed in the original Turley matter. There were a number of other issues in which Mr. Parsons complains that the trial court erred in failing on a number of issues. I want to briefly touch on this alleged sua sponte order that came down out of the trial court regarding the issue of punitive damages. I don't know where they draw the conclusion that this was a sua sponte order. This was an order as a result of motions for summary judgment to do away with the punitive damages. So it wasn't like the trial court just said, okay, we're going to decide, here's what we're going to do. There was a hearing on the summary judgment. The trial court rendered an order as a result of this.
Maybe I misheard. I understood what he was saying was the first sentence of the order does away with punitive damages, and the second sentence, by implication, does away with all remaining causes of action.
It does not, Your Honor. And even if that's what their accusation is and their claims are, it specifically said, and there was another summary judgment that dealt with the fracturing of all of the different causes of action, that according to Texas law, and the cases are cited both in Motzenbacher's brief and Greenberg's brief, that you cannot fracture all of the various causes of action in a legal malpractice case. And that's what the trial court held. The trial court allowed the legal malpractice claims to go forward to the jury. That's what the jury held. That's what was presented to the jury. The jury properly rendered a verdict of zero damages against the Greenberg defendant, and I see my time's about up, and we'd ask that the court deny the claims presented to the court on the appellant's behalf. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just work from back to front, just to answer that statement at the end. This issue of fracturing and courts' increasing tendency to disallow claims for breaches of fiduciary duty and fraud is one reason why this court's opportunity to apply Akin Gump to send a message to the bar is so important. Right now, as it stands, it's so difficult to get to the jury with a breach of fiduciary duty cause of action that the Akin Gump notion that negligently caused fees is a secondary cause of action that you could pursue more successfully is very important. And I know that when attorneys are fresh out of law school, we get a lot of speeches and seminars and CLEs about how to avoid malpractice, and I'd like to see this kind of thing talked about at a malpractice seminar where, hey, if you're not careful about the way you pursue your case, if you commit an act of negligence and thereafter your fees are tied to that, then you could end up having to regurgitate those fees at a later time. And I think that because breach of fiduciary duty has been so weakened as a cause of action, that in terms of keeping the bar on its toes, that this Akin Gump 2008, that this new theory is an important one for Texas jurisprudence. We just, again, working from back to front, the differences between Roger Parsons' case and the Akin Gump case are pretty palpable. As Jim Ross mentioned, aside from the Dorsanio and the Professor Armour fees that were awarded by the trial, the other attorneys' fees were not awarded. Now, the difference between what those attorneys were doing at that time is primarily that they were busy pursuing NDR, the plaintiff. They were busy pursuing NDR's cause of action. Right, and it turns out that they didn't do as good a job as they should have. And but under Akin Gump, because the way it's structured, you can't get those attorney fees. In my client's case, the appellee lawyers were not pursuing his cause of action. They were appealing the dismissal of his cause of action for statute of limitations reasons. Now, those fees are directly and intrinsically caused by their negligence. You cannot get around that. That's the primary difference between my client's case and Akin Gump. The other primary difference, the other important difference, is that we were at pretrial when all this happened with my client. And everyone knows 90% of cases settle before trial, right? The fact that the suit was not perfected in time deprived my client of the opportunity to negotiate an end to this prior to trial. This is a pretty strong difference between my client's case and Akin and Gump. So if we were going to extend my client's case by way of analogy, say he wins the appeal and gets back on track, and then he has to appeal after that because he lost, then that second set of appellate fees would not be caused by the negligence. It would be a straight comparison between Akin and Gump. But in this particular case, it's entirely distinguishable, and it's much more in line with the fees paid to Professors Armour and Dorsanio. We can split hairs about how strong the case against lost punitives was in 1996 when appellee lawyer Greenberg first took on Roger Parsons' case. As a matter of fact, 1996, and a couple months before that case started, the New York Court of Appeals came down with a decision denying lost punitives. I've got their opinion excerpted in my brief, and it tracks Joe Spence's summary judgment motion. Had Greenberg and Motzenbacher bothered to look, they would have seen that. The issue here is that not only is not whether the case now against lost punitives is stronger than it was back in 1996. The issue is that Greenberg and Motzenbacher didn't even bother to investigate the claim to begin with, to vet it at all, to inform my client that there was any danger that he would be poured out if they pursued this cause of action because of the public policy that supports punitive damages to begin with. Had they addressed it, that would be a different argument, but it was not addressed at all, and that's a clear breach of attorney duties that we owe our clients. And again, let me just reiterate that these incidences of negligence, the failure to perfect in time, and the failure to vet these damages, are interlocking. And because of that fact, it's less important whether this made it before the jury or not. By way of rebuttal, I believe I'm finished. Thank you very much for your time.